in the meantime about some of the wildfires which have been tearing through the west coast of the United States. And even if you haven't really been following what's been going on with the fires, and to be fair, there's a lot of news around, you'd find it very difficult not to have seen some of the photographs that have been doing the rounds in the last couple of days of these incredible orange skies throughout some of California's major cities, and indeed in Oregon too, where we heard some of the audio from a little bit earlier this hour. Let's speak to David Wallace Wells. He is the deputy editor and a climate columnist for New York Magazine. He's also the author of The Uninhabitable Earth, and he joins us now via Skype. David, thanks very much for taking our call. I know it's early in the morning where you are, so we do appreciate you getting up early. Obviously, this is a time where we've seen these fires now on the West Coast. There was the wildfires in Australia only at the start of the year. Around this time last year, we saw the wildfires going through the Amazon. Is it possible that all of these is just a confluence of coincidences, or is there some larger coordination at play here?
Well, I would put the Brazil fires aside, and actually this year's fires in Brazil have been just as bad as last year's fires. They just haven't gotten the news attention, because those are largely farmers, ranchers clearing land. It's very intentional human burning, and it's bad for the environment because the Amazon is so important in the planet's ability to absorb carbon and produce oxygen. But it's not the same kind of natural disaster as the ones in Australia and California have been. So I'd set that one aside.
Okay.
In California and all the way up the West Coast in the U.S. and the fires in Australia this year, it seems to obvious to me and obvious to fire scientists, obvious to climate scientists, that this is a problem that is being made much, much worse by the force of climate change. Flammable land in California has grown as many as 900% over the last few decades because of climate change. The fire season there is 2 months longer than it was just a couple of decades ago. So these are, you know, conditions of the environment in these places that always used to exist. There always used to be some amount of wildfire in what is now California. There was always some amount of bushfire in what is now Australia. But climate change is making them much, much worse. And beyond the fires themselves, we're also building out into those places that are vulnerable to fire. So we have in California, 60% of residential buildings since 1990 has taken place in parts of the state that are vulnerable to wildfire. There have been similar patterns in Australia and indeed all over the world. We need to figure out, I think, both how to obviously get climate change under control through rapid decarbonization. But I think even if we do that, we also have to start thinking about how we can come to terms with these increased, more intense fire regimes that we're seeing. Because of the climate change that's already been produced, we're not going to go back to the way that fires used to burn 10 or 20 or 30 years ago. At the absolute very best, it's still going to get considerably worse from where we are now. And that means, I think, in addition to doing a lot of mitigation in terms of cutting carbon, it also means doing some adaptation and learning how to better live amidst these fires.
So just to tease that out and to make sure that people really understand what it is that you're suggesting, the idea is that this is now the new normal, and that even if we were to take aggressive mitigation measures to stop climate change getting any worse, we are going to continue seeing wildfires on this sort of scale with this sort of regularity.
I would say much more often. The earliest that we're likely to see impacts in the climate system as a whole coming from fast climate action that we take today is 20 or 30 years from now. That's how long it would take those to sort of filter through the system and actually make a difference in the amount of hurricanes that we see and the amount of heat waves that we see or the amount of wildfire that we see. So we're going to be dealing with a system that is at least as bad as the one that we have today when it comes to wildfire for at least 20 or 30 years. And over that period of time, 20 or 30 years, scientists expect that the burning in the American West will at least double and probably quadruple in size. So that's not to say that every year will be four times as bad as this year. This year will, over, say, a 10-year time period, this year will likely be an unusually extreme event. But if you average out the period of the last 10 years and you get something like a million acres a year burned in California, which is about 1% of the state, probably 30 years from now, we're going to be dealing with at least 4 million acres a year on average burn. And that means that the extreme outlier years, the equivalent of this year's fires, might be 10 or 12 million acres burned, which is 10 or 12% of the state.
It's an interesting idea that this notion that the next couple of decades are already sort of preordained, because even if you take aggressive action now, that it will just take that long to filter through. In a way, actually, it's almost like how you don't see the change in COVID-19 diagnoses until about a fortnight after you change people's behaviour. But I've never heard that really articulated out loud so much before. Can you just talk us through that? Why is it that, you know, even if we were to take aggressive action now and we were to continue to reduce carbon emissions and do everything we needed to do aggressively every year for the next 10 years, why would it take so long to see that filter through?
Well, the first part of it is that the change is going to be relatively slow. Even quite aggressive pathways to decarbonization are at something like 7 or 10% per year. There's no one who's proposing a global decarbonization program that's any more aggressive than that. And so it's going to take a while for our production to taper out. But it's also the case that carbon hangs in the atmosphere for hundreds of years. So the lion's share of the carbon that's in the atmosphere today has been up there for a while. And every ounce that we put up there is going to stay there for quite a long time. So that blanket is incredibly thick already. It's being made thicker every year. And a lot of the impacts having to do with weather systems and feedback loops and just take quite a long time to play out. So that it's not a direct, as soon as that carbon's in the atmosphere, then the temperature goes up by a certain notch. It had a number of sort of pinball maneuvers the climate system has to make before the temperature reflects the carbon that's in the atmosphere today.
Okay.
And in fact, the last time there was as much carbon in the atmosphere as there is today, it was 4 degrees hotter, not 1 degree hotter. And there were there was tropical plant life near the Arctic Circle. So we're already in a place where we're likely to see considerably more warming, no matter what we do. And that's one reason why I think, I mean, I'm of course an incredibly forceful proponent for rapid decarbonization, but I think the fires show us that actually that's not enough. We need to start doing a lot more adaptation too, because even the climate that we have today, which is likely to get considerably worse, but even the climate that we have today is essentially inhospitable and maybe in certain parts of the world even uninhabitable.
I know that there are some people who will always sort of take the more skeptical view on this, and they'll point to suggestions that this isn't some sort of systematic change. But even parking that for a moment, you have written quite extensively in your book, but also more recently in the New York magazine as well, about how there can be positives to even what you would label as climate alarmism. What are those positives?
Well, I think if you look at the climate politics that we've seen unfold over the last couple of years, there's been an enormous amount of progress. We have, you know, countries across Europe, the UK committing to a zero carbon target by 2050. They haven't done enough to allow us to believe they'll meet their target, but they're at least announcing it. Denmark, Sweden, Norway, these are countries that have made even more aggressive pledges. In the US, we're talking about a Green New Deal. Joe Biden, who used to be considered a hopelessly retrograde climate candidate by climate activists in the US, is now pushing a plan that is much, much more aggressive than Hillary Clinton's, which was much, much more aggressive than Barack Obama's, which was much more aggressive than any president who had come before. So we're seeing this kind of rapid movement of climate politics. And I think that's sort of undeniably the result of the climate activism that we've seen over the last 18 months to 2 years, really since the UN produced this report on how much worse 2 degrees would be than 1.5 degrees of warming. That's really when you started to hear of people like Greta Thunberg, of Extinction Rebellion in the US, of the Sunrise Movement. And all of this out in the street activism and protest has been pitched at an incredibly alarmist tone. It's very, very urgent. You know, Greta gave her first great big speech at Davos. She said, "Our house is on fire. I want you to act as though our house is on fire." That is the essential mood of the climate movement, which is very different from how it had been in previous decades when the tone was much more accommodationist, much more technocratic, much more optimistic. The mood of these new activists is much more alarmist and urgent. And I think that's showing up very, very quickly in our concern about climate at a public level, but maybe even more importantly, in prioritizing climate action at a policy level, which we're not doing nearly at to the degree or at the speed we need to, but it's so much more aggressive and so much more focused on what we do need to do than we were just, you know, 2 or 3 years ago.
So is it fair then to summarize, David, and sorry to interrupt you, that basically alarmism kind of has this good rallying effect and that it has sort of worked, but that obviously we just need it to work much more dramatically now?
Absolutely. And, you know, there are downsides that it turns some people off, but that's how radical political activism always works. It's not meant to persuade the most the middle of the road voter. It's meant to move the whole conversation so the world as a whole understands just how vital, say, civil rights or women's rights are. And climate change is working in the same way. There are people who are turned off by Greta and Extinction Rebellion as they, you know, they perfectly allowed to. But as a whole, the conversation has moved to a much more urgent, aggressive place. And I think that's incredibly productive. We just need to, as you say, move much faster still.
I'm running out of time, but just very briefly, you mentioned some of the short term things that we need to do to try and live with the world as it's going to be now for the next couple of decades. In a couple of sentences, what needs to be done?
Well, in California, for instance, they've stopped burning forests under what's called controlled burn, where you basically allow the forest to burn so that there's not this huge buildup of fuel. Scientists say that we need to burn about 20 million acres in California to sort of reset the fire ecology of the state, which would bring us back to a much more manageable level of wildfire. So that means that the state and the federal government need to actively, proactively burn 20 million acres, which is about 7 times as much as burned this year. They also need to change their housing regulations so that we can build more densely in places like San Francisco and Los Angeles, rather than pushing people farther and farther into the wildland where they're vulnerable to fire.
It's interesting to see whether that will be taken up. We're out of time. David Wallace Wells, thanks so much for taking our call this morning. That's David Wallace Wells. He is a climate columnist for New York Magazine, and he's the author of The Uninhabitable Earth.